Really? Okay. I was counting on you, Thomas. But okay. Yeah, I don't know if any of you guys have heard this game, Saboteur. This is a card game that, back in the back, we got some, okay. A card game that was really popular a few years ago, and I've played it a bunch of times. And basically in this game, you are playing as dwarves who are digging for gold, right? And it's kind of a cooperative game. You're trying to figure out how to get to this gold, except hidden among the players are a couple saboteurs. They're secretly trying to sabotage you from getting to the gold. And so your job is to kind of at the key moment, explode the tunnel that you're digging and stop everybody from getting to the gold and betray everybody, and everyone gets mad at you, and it's a lot of fun. But this game is actually, it's hard to win when you play as a saboteur. You kind of get given this role at the beginning secretly, because if everybody else just cooperates and gets along and works together, it can be really difficult to beat them and stop them from getting to the gold. Back when I was a youth pastor, I played the game with a bunch of the junior high boys. We were hanging out one day. They came over to my house. And you play three rounds, and I was a saboteur every single time, which doesn't happen very often. And it's really hard to win when you're the saboteur, especially if you're the saboteur multiple rows or turns in a row. But I creamed these guys, just demolished them. And here's why I did. Because as I said, it's really kind of hard to beat the good guys if they're just working together and cooperating. But let me give you a little bit of secret knowledge that I picked up as a youth pastor. Junior high boys are a lot better at competing than they are at cooperating. They don't do a good job of working together. And when I really shouldn't have beat them, I just demolished them at this game because they couldn't trust each other and work together, and I may have sowed some discord in there to help with that. But they just fought against each other the whole time, and I was able to beat them. Now, laying aside for a minute the question of morality of games that involve bluffing, we're not going to talk about that today. I want us to think a little bit more about why did these guys lose? They were better at competing than cooperating. And the reason for that isn't something that's just unique to junior high boys, but something that we all have in our lives, and that's pride, ego. The desire to be number one, right? That's something that we all have inside of us at some level. We struggle with it in different ways. It comes out in different ways. And not all junior hires are like this, you know, in immense ways, but something about, I feel like just that initial going through puberty and going to school where the social hierarchies start to become really pronounced and everyone's just comparing themselves to everyone and trying to figure out how they fit in. It really kind of comes out, I think, in a big way in those days. And I remember being there. If you remember how challenging those days were, if you can think back to that, or maybe you're going through that right now if you're one of the kids here, trying to remember, you know, who's the greatest? How do I fit in? Guys, I'm really thankful that I'm not there in that age group anymore because it does die down a little bit. But that pride that comes out in force in junior high lives in us after that for years. It's still there, isn't it? Like we hate looking stupid. We hate looking stupid. We want so badly to be recognized for our achievements. We daydream about winning and about being respected and famous and what I should have said to that jerk to put him in his place. Don't we? That's pride, right? That's something that lives inside of all of us. And it's a problem in all of us, too. Today we're looking at this passage that was read to us by Sarah a moment ago. And in this passage in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus addresses the issue of pride in his disciples. He draws it out of his 12 closest friends, his 12 apostles, and he makes it clear to them that in his kingdom, there isn't room for their egos. In his kingdom, there's no room for their pride. We're going to look at this passage today, and as we do, I want to challenge each and every one of you and challenge myself again to hold this passage up to yourself and let it be a mirror that's going to expose the pride that lives in each and every one of our hearts. There's no room for your pride in the kingdom of God. This passage is going to remind us of his kingdom is like, what the kingdom of Jesus is like. And it's going to show us how we can change by following the example of Jesus, who is our humble king. So let's look at this passage together. We're going to see three truths in here about pride and the kingdom of Jesus. And the first truth that we're going to see is this, that in the kingdom of Jesus, rejection is the way to victory. In the kingdom of Jesus, rejection is the way to victory. So we're in Luke chapter 9. Do you guys remember what was happening just before this? What did Jesus just do up on a mountain? That's right. There was the transfiguration. Right? Jesus went up on a mountain to pray with Peter, James, and John. And while he was up there, his glory as God was revealed to these three. He was seen talking to Elijah and Moses. And they saw a revelation of who Jesus truly was. He's God in flesh. And then last week, Sean preached the next little bit. They come down from the mountain. And when they're there, a large crowd is gathered. And when the crowd is gathered, a man comes to Jesus and asks for something. Do you remember what that is? He asks for Jesus to cast a demon out of his son. He says, your disciples haven't been able to do it. I asked them, the nine that you left behind, and they haven't been able to help my son. Jesus, can you do it for me, please? And Sean showed us last week in verse 41 this shocking response that Jesus has. It's not really something that we're expecting if we're reading through this. Look at verse 41, Luke 9, 41. Jesus says, you unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? And then he casts the demons out of the boy. And verse 43 tells us how the crowds reacted to what Jesus did. Verse 43 says, and they were amazed at the greatness of God. And then our passage picks up the second half of that verse today, right? Starts a new paragraph. It says, while everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he says to his disciples. So he pulls his disciples aside from this crowd that's mind is blown. They're amazed. And this is what Jesus says. Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. So we look at this passage. We kind of start to wonder, what's going on with Jesus? He seems a bit grumpy today. Right? He blasts this crowd when this man asks for help, calls them an unbelieving and perverse generation. How long do I have to put up with you? And then when he heals the boy, casts the demon out, and the crowd's marveling, you'd think, well, go and talk to the crowd about God and his kingdom. And he pulls his disciples aside and says, guys, listen to this. The Son of Man, that's a name that he called himself, pulls up from the Old Testament, is going to be delivered into the hands of men. What is Jesus, what's going on with Jesus here? Here's what we need to remember, right? Jesus doesn't get grumpy, right? He's not like us. He doesn't get his priorities mixed up. He doesn't, you know, let situations affect the way that he acts and doesn't do it in sinful ways. So if Jesus is acting in a certain way, there's a good reason for it, right? So what's the reason for what's going on here, the way that Jesus is acting? We've got to zoom out a little bit again and remember what's going on in this passage. Chapter 9 of Luke is a big turning point in Luke's gospel. It's sort of the end of the first half of the story. We talked about Luke has sort of four major sections to it. If you remember that graphic of the gospel of Luke that Sarah designed, there's sort of four parts to it. There's the one with the star, Jesus' birth, and there's one with a crown, because we've been in this second section of Jesus going around Galilee, the northern part of Israel, and talking about the kingdom of God. And the question that's coming up over and over again in that section is, who is Jesus? Who is he who can do these things? And in chapter 9, we start to get the answer to that question, that he is God's Messiah. He is the king that God has sent. He's the king of God's kingdom. And then chapter 9 in verse 50, there's a big hinge verse. Sorry, verse 51 tells us this. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And that brings us into the third major section, which we're going to start in the new year after we go through Advent. That Jesus is now on the way to Jerusalem. He's on the road to Jerusalem, getting ready for his crucifixion. And the final section is the story of his last week, the triumphal entry, the crucifixion, his resurrection and ascension. And so we're transitioning into this time of who is Jesus, learning about the kingdom, to this time of now, okay, we're going to Jerusalem and the crucifixion is on its way. And these themes start coming up of what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? It's not what the disciples had expected it was going to be. And in chapter 9, we start to see the disciples just don't really get it. Though they figure out that he's the Messiah, they don't really understand the rest of the story. And Jesus starts saying, guys, I have to die. I'm going to die. I came to die for you and rise again. And they don't get it. See, they're thinking again that Jesus as the king is coming to lead an army and destroy Rome, right? And so when they look at this crowd that's gathered, they see these people that are flocking to Jesus. They're thinking, all right, this is it. We're getting a following. This is the beginnings of our army. We're going to go and defeat the Romans. This is what we're trying to do, right, is gather this crowd to accept us and come after us. And then Jesus sees them and says, you perverse and unbelieving generation. This crowd, how long am I going to put up with you? Which is completely different situation, right? And then he says to the disciples, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. And the Greek in there is literally, put this in your ears. Or we might say, get this into your heads, guys. I'm about to be killed by this crowd. This crowd is fickle. They're not on board for what's coming. And I'm going to die because of them. They're not going to crown me as king. They're going to reject me and kill me. Look at verse 45, how the disciples respond to this. It says, but they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, and they did not grasp it. And they were afraid to ask him about it. They just have no idea how to respond to Jesus in this. They can't wrap their minds around it, and they don't really want to, right? They don't want to know more. They're afraid to find out what Jesus is talking about, so they don't even ask what he means. For the disciples, rejection by the crowd means defeat by the Romans, but acceptance by the crowd means victory. And that's reasonable, right? Like, that's how we all kind of feel in life. We want to be accepted. We want to be liked. We want to be respected. And that's true in a lot of areas in our life. It's hard. As Christians, we're called to stand with Jesus when it's unpopular, to tell people about him, to live a life that's different. And that's difficult to do. Because if we do that, if people find out what we believe and what we stand for and what we, you know, who we are, if we're not just shouted down publicly, we'll be quietly ignored by a lot of people. People will think we're crazy. We'll think we're unintelligent, we're bigoted, we're judgmental. Even if we've shown them in relationship that we're not like that, it won't matter. We'll be labeled those things. And it stinks. It's a terrible feeling to know people feel that way about you, think that about you. Right? And the more I think about my analogy about junior high boys at the beginning of this, the more I realize, man, it just applies to all of us. We never really escape that stage of life in some ways, do we? When I was in junior high, being accepted was so important. Being cool was so important to me. And the biggest part of that was how you dressed, right? Having the right clothes in grade 7, 8, that just made your experience in junior high or broke it. And I never had the right clothes. And so, I mean, I was okay, but when I went to school, I knew where I stood in the social rankings, right? I don't think that's changed, but I'll tell you what has changed. The fashion has changed since then. When I was in junior high, in order to be cool, you had to wear the baggiest jeans that have ever been invented in the history of humanity. If you don't know what I'm talking about or have forgotten, and you have a cell phone on you with internet, I'd ask you right now to just do a Google search for JNCO jeans. And look at how big they were. I could fit my waist into the ankle of these jeans. I'm not even kidding. They were enormous and stupid looking, but they were so cool. And I never had a pair of those. I couldn't even get close to those. My parents wouldn't let me wear them. They couldn't afford them. But they meant so much. Like, if you're laughing and you're looking them up, like, they look ridiculous. I wouldn't be caught dead in pants like that now. Guys, we don't outgrow that. I have that same desire to be accepted in my heart today. It's not about jeans anymore, thankfully. But the things that I care about are just as temporary. They're just as ridiculous. I wish I could take the junior hires that I know by the shoulders and say, you guys are being crazy. It doesn't matter what your shirt says on the front of it. But I need someone to do that to me too. You're being crazy. It doesn't matter what people think about you. It doesn't matter what they say about you. The acceptance that you crave, it's temporary. It's silly. It's prideful. You're missing what's important. The disciples are afraid to ask Jesus about what he means, and they miss the good news that goes along with it, that comes out of his words of rejection. You see, it turns out the disciples are part of this unbelieving and perverse generation. They don't get it. They won't listen to Jesus and believe what he's saying. They can't because their own plans, their own pride, their own desire for acceptance trips them up from understanding the good news of Jesus. But the good news is that's why he died, right? Because our sin, our pride was blocking us from knowing Jesus, from knowing God. And so he came to lay down his life for us. Because when we care more about what other people think or what we want, we make ourselves enemies of the king, rebels against God. And when the kingdom of God comes, we face it not as his citizens, but as those who've rejected him and who deserve his punishment. But Jesus, who came as the king, didn't come to be the conquering king that the disciples wanted, which is good for them and good for us. They didn't realize that they were on the other side of this. They would have been the ones who needed to be conquered. He was the king who came to lay down his life for his enemies and to be rejected and to die in their place because he loves us. He was willing to suffer rejection and death at the hands of mankind and the divine punishment of his Father so that we could be forgiven and brought back into his kingdom and adopted as children of God. Because it's in the kingdom of Jesus, it's the rejection that leads to victory. Do you remember back in verse 22, a few weeks ago, we said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and must be killed, and on the third day raised again, raised to life. Jesus knew that that death and that rejection wasn't the end of the story for him. After his death, he would be raised to life. And he calls us to live by faith in his death and resurrection, knowing that we're forgiven and loved, that we have the promise of eternal life with our King, the King who defeated sin and death. But here's the thing. In order to accept this gift, right, in order to understand this gift and receive the eternal life, we have to get over our pride that prevents us from accepting the gift, right? Christmas is coming, guys. We know we don't give gifts anymore. We exchange gifts of equitable value, right? We do gift exchange. My family just set this up, $35 limit. You all have your person you're giving. Like, we don't give gifts anymore. We don't know what it means to humbly receive a gift that we haven't earned. It has to be something that I can pay back and I can look good about, right? With family stuff, I understand why you do it. There's reasons for it. It's not a bad thing. But it's not gift-giving anymore, right? And we don't know what it means to receive the gift of God because our pride gets in the way. We want to earn it. We want to do our own thing. We want to live for ourselves and be accepted by people. Friends, if you've never laid aside your pride and accepted the gift of forgiveness and love that Jesus so freely offered, then he paid for it with a great price, you can do that right now. You can accept it in this very moment and be forgiven and loved. Your pride is preventing you from knowing God. Your sin has made you a rebel and an enemy, and yet he loves you and has laid down his life for you. And if you are already a follower of God, don't forget that. Don't start living by your pride again. Don't start living by your desire for acceptance and being quiet around people that don't love Jesus and need to hear about him. In the kingdom of Jesus, victory comes through rejection. Came that way for him, is going to come that way for us. That's the first truth. The second truth is this: in the kingdom of Jesus, humility is the way to greatness. Look at verse 46. Verse 46 says this: an argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Just in case the previous verse wasn't clear, when it says the disciples don't get it, the disciples don't get it. Like, they don't get it. Shortly after, Jesus tries to tell them, you need to be willing to be rejected to find victory, to humble yourself before God. They get into argument about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of Jesus. When he takes his throne, who's going to be the most important member of his inner circle? Who's going to be the right-hand man? Yeah, his face is going to be on most of the currency, but who gets to be Sir Wilfrid Laurier and be on the $5 bill? Right? Who gets to be second? Who gets to be the greatest after Jesus? But look how Jesus responds. Verse 47. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For it is the one who is least among you who is the greatest. Jesus grabs a kid, pulls him next to him and says, I want you to be the kind of people who welcome kids. What's that about? Jesus' disciples lived in a world where child mortality was high. Kids didn't live long. Families had lots of kids so that they could keep some at the end of it all. They lived in a world where preventable diseases that we know now were unknown and untreatable. They lived in a world where most people lived hand to mouth after doing heavy manual labor and making enough for today to feed their families and hoping that they would find work and be fruitful tomorrow to continue to do that. So a kid who might not live to be useful, it wasn't useful now, didn't have a lot of value in their society. There's actually Hebrew proverbs that aren't part of the Bible that are just sort of commonly known wisdom that talk about the things in your life that are a waste of time and will bring you to destruction. Things like gambling, spending time with people who are irreparable lifestyles, and talking to kids. Like, just not worth it. Don't waste your time doing that. It's horrible. That's the way they lived, though. That was the culture that they lived in. And Jesus says, I know you guys think kids don't make sense. They care way too much about how baggy their jeans are. They can't provide for your families. They can't join our army to overthrow the Romans. But I want you to be the kind of people that cares about kids, that welcomes kids. You think that you're too important for that. There's more important things that you should be doing with your time. This is a job for their moms, somebody else, not me. We're too important too important for this. We're doing big things like arguing about who's going to be the greatest. But Jesus says in verse 48, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. That's God the Father, right? Jesus says, no, don't think about yourselves that way. Don't think about other people that way. Verse 48, for the one who is the least among you is the one who is the greatest. Now, Jesus isn't buying into their cultural blind spot about children. He's not saying, yeah, kids are the greatest because they're the least, or the ones who care about kids are the greatest. He's not saying mothering is a non-important job. He's saying, in the way that you see the world, let me show you a completely upside-down way that I want you to think. To stop thinking about yourself as so important and more important, but to be the kind of person who humbles themselves and cares about the least of these. Greatness doesn't come from vying for position and trying to make yourself the greatest and competing to be the top person. Greatness doesn't come from putting others down so you look more important. Greatness comes from humility. Man, that was my experience in junior high. I know a lot of, I feel like I'm being really harsh on junior high kids. There are some great junior high kids in the world, right? They're gentle and kind and sensitive and lovely. But I've gone on enough junior high retreats to know that when you get a cabin full of junior high boys together, man, it's like Lord of the Flies knew what it was talking about, right? Like, I mean, you remember. Every time we go into the cabin at nighttime, it just turns into a huge WrestleMania in there, right? We compete about everything. Who can drink the most hot sauce before lunch comes? Who can insult each other the best? Who can do the best prank on the others? And if you think I made any of those examples up, I didn't. And again, we grow up, right? We learn and we mature. But we don't grow out of that desire to be the greatest. We don't. It's still there in all of us. We express it differently, but we still get offended when people contradict us, right? It hurts. We don't like looking dumb. If we're married, we expect our spouses to act like we're the center of their universe. And when they don't act that way because we're not the center of their universe, we're only the center of our own universe, it really makes us mad. We treat them with a silent treatment. We blow up at them. When we want things done our way at home or at church and it's not done that way, we just grumble. Maybe we complain out loud. I hear that from some people. Maybe we just murmur on our own with our friends. We want to be the greatest. We want to get things our way. We want our pride to be sated. This story that I'm about to tell, I'm so embarrassed of it. It's such a dumb story. I graduated from seminary a few years ago, and I expected that I was going to get a certain recognition when I graduated, and my GPA was 0.01 points lower than it needed to be. And I was, like, I did well. It's like humble bragging here, but I was so angry that I didn't get this thing that I was supposed to get that nobody else cared about and wouldn't have ever mattered ever again. And I could see this ugliness bubbling out of my heart. And I just didn't care. I was so upset. I'll tell you what, I did win the preaching award for that year because I was in a class full of students who'd never preached before, and I was a pastor and I do it for a living. No, big whoop, Steve. I pointed it out to people every chance I could get. People would talk about the preaching award. I won that. Like, And I'd say it, and like this voice in the back of my head is like, you sound like such a moron right now. Your pride is so obvious to everyone. I feel sick even thinking about that. I'm so glad Jesus isn't like me. I'm so glad Jesus doesn't care about being the greatest. He is the greatest, right? And he his glory, he deserves that. And yet Philippians tells us he didn't consider his position with his father as God, his power to be something he grasped to, but he made himself a servant. He's the king who laid down his life for his rebels because he loved us. Man, thank God Jesus isn't like me. The kingdom of Jesus, humility is the way to greatness. And thirdly, we're going to see in this passage that in Jesus' kingdom, cooperation is the way to success. In Jesus' kingdom, cooperation is the way to success. So Jesus finishes talking to the disciples about humility, and then John pipes up. John is going to be one of the most important leaders in the early church. Verse 49 says, "Master," John says, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he's not one of us." This is mind-boggling. So incredible. Not only did everything Jesus just said go whoosh, fly right over John's head, right? Like, he just doesn't get it. But John can't even see the irony that a few verses earlier, the disciples were unable to cast out a demon, right? John was up on the mountain with Jesus when it was happening. He wasn't there. But you think at least that would give him pause before he brags about, oh, we stopped some guy who was casting out demons in your names because he's not part of our crew. He's boasting about this. Looking for approval from Jesus. Didn't I do a good job, Jesus? We don't know who this guy was, this man that was casting out demons in Jesus' name, but apparently he's a true follower of Jesus, right? We go through the Gospels and we see that there are true followers of Jesus that don't come with them on the journey. Lazarus, Mary, Martha, the guy that Jesus cast the demon out on the other side of the lake and tells to stay there. There are people that are followers of Jesus that don't come with them on the journey of the disciples. But for John and the other disciples, you're either with us or you're nothing. You're in this or you're just stay out of this. If you're not part of us, we don't want anything to do with you and shut up. But Jesus says in verse 50, don't stop him. He says, don't stop him, Jesus says, for whoever is not against you is for you. Jesus says, he's helping people in my name. He's pointing them to me. Why would you stop him? Why would John stop him? The only reason is because John's mission is not the same as Jesus' mission. Right? I've never played basketball on a team in my life, but if I did, and I'm on a team, and my team is winning, and just like crushing the other team, because my teammate is just running circles around the other team and sinking everything he shoots, I should be happy. My team is winning. But if my personal goal is not for my team to win, but for me to be the star of the game, the most important and best-looking player in the game, then I'm not going to be happy, right? I'm going to be upset that that guy's doing better than me. That's what John is doing. That's what the disciples were dealing with. They weren't about serving Jesus and making him look great. They were about drafting in Jesus' wake and looking great themselves, following him to greatness. He's not willing to be humble, John isn't yet. He's certainly not willing to cooperate and let other people take the spotlight. He's not willing to suffer rejection. He'll get there. But in this place, he's not there yet. I remember, again, in junior high, wishing so badly that I was popular and athletic and cool. I wanted to be in the spotlight so badly. You can't help but not like the people that are there, right? The people that are popular and probably mean to you and just are naturally athletic or naturally talented or naturally funny or naturally outgoing or naturally, you know, have the right clothes or whatever it is. You can't help but be frustrated that you're not like them. That's pride, and I haven't outgrown it. As an adult, it's still easy to fight for the spotlight. It's hard to let people do things when you're pretty sure you could do it better than them. It's hard to let other people get credit. It's hard to not fight for it yourself. The reality is it's Jesus is the one who deserves the spotlight, right? And if we're the church, that means he's left the task of representing him to us, even though we're kind of a mess. I mean, we don't do a great job of representing him. And yet he said, I want you to do this. I'm willing to let you do this. The church is designed around encouraging and helping one another. It's designed to be about a diverse group of people who are different and have different gifts and abilities and strength that God has given us. They don't come from ourselves, that we come together to serve Jesus. That we're supposed to be cooperating and letting others serve and not craving the spotlight ourselves, being content with who God has made us to be. Being content with the story that God's given you, the background that God's given you. Being content with the gifts and the opportunity that God has given you for ministry. Whether that's being a mom, pointing your kids to Jesus, writing cards to people who are shut in, discipling and encouraging someone, preaching, serving as a deacon, whatever it is. Some of these roles are just by their nature more upfront than others, says the guy's preaching right now. But none of us are more important than the other. And it's only by cooperating, it's only by loving one another and working together and not vying for that spotlight? Are we going to ever have success in the mission that Christ has given us? Being content and cooperating to serve Jesus is hard. It can be difficult because we're prideful. There's no room for pride in the kingdom of Jesus. Guys, we need to learn to identify the pride that's in our own hearts. Parents, we need to learn to identify the pride that's in our kids' hearts. When we see that pride, we need to be careful, on the one hand, not to just nurse the wounded egos or stroke them so that they grow, but on the other hand, not to condemn ourselves or others, but to look to Jesus, right, as he's our example and our king. To remember the good news of what he's done for us, to forgive us for our pride and our sin, but also to change us, right? The resurrection means new life in him. To know that he sent his spirit to work in us and change our hearts to be more like Christ. We need to remember these truths. And that's why we take communion. That's one of the ways that we've been given by Christ to remember these truths and to look to him for growth and for strength and for change in our lives.